All right. So, okay. So this is a continuous story. I'm going to go ahead and just, in the interest of time, well, no, I am going to read the chapter. All right. Because I want you to get the whole story. So this is John chapter 21 from the New American Standard Bible. After these things, so this is coming on the tail end of chapter 20, right, where Jesus appeared to Mary, and then he appeared to the 12 in the upper room, and then he appeared to the 12 again. Well, I say the 12. It wasn't 12 at the time, right? It was 10, and then the next week it was 11 because Thomas showed up. And so it's after those things. After these things, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. That's the Sea of Galilee, by the way. He revealed himself in this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, who is called Didymus, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." They said to him, "We are also coming with you." They went out and got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. But when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, "Children, you do not have any fish to eat, do you?" They answered him, "No." And he said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find the fish." So they cast it, and they were not able to haul in because of the great quantity of fish. Verse 7, therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. I love that. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from the land, but about 200 cubits away, dragging the net full of fish. So when they got out on the land, they saw a charcoal fire already made and fish placed on it. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish which you have now caught." So Simon Peter went up and hauled the net to land full of large fish, 153. Although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples ventured to inquire of him, "Who are you?" knowing that it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and the fish likewise. This was now the third time Jesus revealed himself to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. Now, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him again, that is, Jesus said to Peter again, "Tend my lambs." He said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, that is, Peter said to Jesus, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Shepherd my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus said to him, he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." Now Jesus is speaking. "Truly, truly, I tell you, when you were younger, you used to put on your belt and walk wherever you wanted. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will put your belt on you and bring you where you do not want to go." Now he said this, indicating by what kind of death he would glorify God. And when he had said this, he said to him, that is, Jesus said to Peter, "Follow me." Peter turned around and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who had also leaned back on his chest at the supper and said, "Lord, who is the one betraying you?" So Peter, upon seeing him, said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, that is, Jesus said to Peter, "If I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." Therefore, this account went out among the brothers that that disciple, that is John, would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but only, "If I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you?" This is the disciple who is testifying about these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. But there are also many other things which Jesus did, which if they were written in detail, I expect even the world itself would not contain all the books that would be written, right? So let's go back up to verse 1. Jesus reveals himself to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. So Tiberias was the emperor during Jesus' life on earth. from AD 14 until 37. And so in the Synoptic Gospels, this large lake is referred to as the Sea of Galilee. That's probably what you most likely know it as. It's also called the Sea of Gennesaret or the Lake of Gennesaret. Gennesaret is a region that is on the east side of the lake. And then here, it's very common when an emperor is in power, particularly for a longer period of time, that cities are built and named after him. So for instance, there's Caesarea of Philippi. That's named after Caesar, Caesarea of Philippi. And this is a common thing. So it's interesting, and it gives us an idea of who John's audience is when we see that he calls this the Sea of Tiberias. John is definitely focused toward the Gentiles more than the Jews. He's constantly giving you the alternate names for Hebrew terms, okay? And this is another example of that. He's speaking this gospel, he's writing this gospel to the Gentiles who are a part of the Roman Empire, okay? So then how did Jesus reveal himself at the Sea of Tiberias? Well, so there are seven disciples here, Simon Peter, Thomas, called Didymus, which means the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, that's two, James and John, and two others that are not named. So there's seven disciples. Simon Peter says, hey, I'm going fishing. They say, we're going to come with you. And they went out and got into the boat that night and they caught nothing. So the last time we encountered the disciples, they were in Judea, which is way down south. Now they're up north where we met them originally. Okay. Well, actually, let me hesitate. We were introduced to them when they were being baptized by John the Baptist, and that was down south near Judea, right? But then they travel back up north to Galilee where they're all from. That's where you meet Nathanael, by the way. And so if you go back to chapter one, you find this is kind of like a full circle experience, right? We're returning back to this time, or not really the time, but we're returning back to the place where these disciples first followed Jesus. So that's an interesting thing. That's going to factor into how we look at this. Well, the entirety of chapter 21 is an epilogue, right? So we talked about the prologue. By the way, that's been 14 months ago. Do you realize that? I started teaching from John in March of last year. That's quite a while ago, okay? The prologue to John is John 1, 1 through 18, okay? That's like an introduction. This is the epilogue. This comes after. John could have easily concluded at the end of chapter 20. 20:31 tells us what John, what the purpose of John's gospel is, right? I've written these things that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. They could have ended it right there. But this epilogue is appended to it. And the purpose of it is so that we will see, and those early disciples, more importantly, will see that Peter, who denied Jesus three times, was restored. He was publicly restored by Jesus, okay? So this is very interesting. When we look at the book of Acts, we see that Jesus appeared to Peter by himself. That was after Mary Magdalene, that was the first appearance, okay? He appears to Peter, and then he appears to the 12, and then he appears to James, and then he appears to all of the apostles. He appears to 500 brothers at once, and then the Apostle Paul says, and lastly, he appeared to me as to one untimely born, okay? So Peter knows he's forgiven, but he still has not been restored, right? He's given this great name, Peter, right? The Rock. But he didn't really live up to that, did he? He waffled. He denied Jesus, right? He didn't show this strong character. He showed fear and, you know, self-protection. So the purpose of chapter 21 is to show that Jesus restored Peter to that leadership. That should be encouraging to you. Okay? If you've gone through some difficulty and you feel like you have failed the Lord, that you failed to live up to what you believed the Lord's expectations were for you, know this, he hasn't given up on you. He didn't give up on Peter, okay? So, you know, Peter, I think, knows he's forgiven, but what's he going to do with his life? He doesn't, you know, feel like he's worthy. I think that's the big issue with Peter, is this sense of unworthiness. As we're going to see, we find that even at the beginning, when Peter is called to Jesus, he has that sense of unworthiness. You know what? That's not entirely unhealthy. We're made worthy. If you think you're worthy because of all the good things you do, you don't realize how unworthy all of us really are. So this is not a terrible thing. So, you know, Peter's like, I don't know what to do with my life. What do I do? Well, you go back to what you know. What did Peter know? Fishing. He was a professional fisherman. So, okay. He gave up his career. Remember? Like, you know, they pulled up the boats and they threw the nets into the boats and they followed Jesus. There's a really great song. In fact, I just heard it, or I might not remember it right now, but I just heard it on my playlist on my phone. By an artist, a Christian artist named Stephen Curtis Chapman. And I'm not even sure what the title of the song is, but it has a line in it, I think it's the chorus, that says, we will abandon it all for the sake of the call. Abandon it all for the sake of the call. That's what Peter and these other disciples did. They abandoned their life, okay? They gave everything up and followed Jesus. And that's why when Jesus was crucified, I mean, it was like the end of the end of the end. But now that Jesus is raised, they still don't really fully understand what that is going to mean when it concerns their lives and their calling. What are they going to do with their lives? What do you do? Do I just go back to fishing and say, hey, I had all these great experiences with Jesus and, you know, share it with, you know, the few people that I encounter? No. Jesus called them and he said, you're going to be fishers of men. I'm going to make you catch. I'm going to teach you how to catch people for God's kingdom. So this brings us full circle, as I said, back to chapter one. The same disciples we met at the beginning have come with Simon. It's obvious that Peter is a leader. Worthy or not, since six others followed him back to the lake to catch fish. See, I've told people this. You can see people that are leaders. If you're a leader, people are going to follow you. And you're going to lead them to something good, or you're going to lead them to something that is less than good, or maybe even something that is bad. I've had young men in my ministry over the years, and I could see that they could be leaders for the kingdom of God. And at times I've been encouraged because some of those men have risen up and become leaders and lead people to Jesus. And I've been discouraged because others have not. Leaders lead and people follow them. And that's what we see here. This is a situation that we find that is reminiscent of Peter's calling. They fished all night long and they caught nothing. That's what happened when we hear of Peter's calling in Luke chapter 5. Well, why? Why didn't they catch anything? They're professional fishermen. I had a theology professor when I was in college that said Jesus did something that night that they didn't realize. He chased fish. That was his way of saying Jesus was making sure that they didn't catch any fish that night. Because he wanted them to realize, without me, you can do nothing. Not even what you're most skilled at. Not even what you're most experienced at. See, what if they would have caught all of those fish? Then they, you know, by themselves, on their, with their own skill, their own power, their own capability. Then they could have assumed, well, I guess we'll just go back to that. But when you try to go back to what you once did and what you once were, and you fail at it, that can cause you to turn back to the Lord. And that's exactly what happened here. Well, I don't know if you've recognized it or not, those of you online, but God has called you to follow Jesus. The question is, do you hear the call? And have you heeded the call? Do you have ears to hear? Jesus said over and over again when he spoke to people, for those who have ears to hear, let them hear or let them listen. He's called you to love and he's called you to worship him. To become a disciple of the Master is learning to become more like Jesus each day. So you've got jobs to do. You've got families. You've got lives. But you need to understand that whatever you're doing, you know, your career, your family, whatever, God's goal is to get you to become more like Jesus. Your goal is to follow Jesus in the midst of all of that. And sometimes we can just be so, distracted. We can be so busy that we fail to understand that you can actually do your job, whatever your job is, and be following Jesus as you do your job. You can be shining your light to others around you as you do what you do, okay? So Peter was called to follow and lead others. What he needed now was restoration, a public reinstatement to leadership, a recommissioning. And that's what happens next. John 2, 4 through 8. But when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach, yet the disciples did not know it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have any fish to eat? You do not have any fish to eat, do you?" So they answered him, "No." And he said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat and you will find fish." So they cast it and they were not able to haul it in because of the great quantity of fish. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved, this is John, said to Peter, "It is the Lord." So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment. So he's basically just wearing a loincloth. That's it. No shirt, no anything. He's just out there working. He's like that kid I was telling you about out here, you know, wearing his underwear, running through the fountain. You know, he's like, whatever, dude. I'm out here. That kid was working it, man. He was having a good time in the fountain. I'm like, you're about six in the humility is going to start coming. He's going to start kicking in about a year or two. Well, as I said, this is a reprise of what happened at Peter's call, which is recorded in Luke's gospel. Listen to Luke's account and lay it down alongside what you just heard, right? They fished all night. They didn't catch anything. So now they're coming back into land because it says they're really close to the shore. So they're coming back into land and they're close enough to the land where this stranger on the shore says, "Children, you don't have any fish to eat, do you?" "No." "Cast your net on the right side of the boat." Well, they could have assumed, you know, maybe he sees something from the land that we can't see looking down here. So they did. Well, listen to what happens. This is at the beginning, right? When Peter and the other disciples are called. "Now, when he," that is Jesus, "had finished speaking, he said to Simon, 'Put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch.' Simon responded and said, 'Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing, but I will do as you say and let down the nets.' And when they had done this, they caught a great quantity of fish and their nets began to tear." So that's the difference between these two. Their nets began to tear here. Their net didn't tear in this instance at the end of John. "So they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them." That's James and John. "And they came and filled both of the boats to the point that they were sinking." That's a lot of fish. "But when Simon Peter saw this, he fell down at Jesus' knees saying, 'Go away from me, Lord, for I'm a sinful man.'" See, that unworthiness is there again. "For amazement had seized him and all his companions because of the catch of fish which they had taken. And likewise also were James and John, sons of Zebedee," excuse me, "who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, 'Do not fear. From now on, you will be catching people.' When they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him." I love that. They said, you know, "We're giving it all. We're pushing all the chips in. We're going to follow you." But see what happens when you're disappointed, right? What happens when things don't turn out the way you thought they were going to turn out? That's exactly where these disciples were, right? And maybe I'll speak more about this when we get to our anniversary, but you know, things didn't turn out the way I thought they were going to turn out when I started this church. So what do? You're responding to God's call. God has called you or he has not called you, okay? So if he has called us, then we're going to respond to his call. We're not going to respond to what we think the results are going to be. Well, Simon recognized that he was unworthy from the beginning. He had not believed Jesus could or would be able to help him. Now, Peter's in the same state of unworthiness, and Jesus repeats the miracle of this large catch of fish. So, faith-filled John is the first to recognize that the stranger on the shore is Jesus. Peter shows respect and puts his outer garment back on before leaping into the water to swim to his Lord. The history of covering one's nakedness goes all the way back to the garden, remember? Adam and Eve eat the fruit of the tree and they immediately seek to cover their nakedness. So there are two things working here. There's respect for Jesus, okay? And there is also this sense of unworthiness that's there once again. All of us recognize our unworthiness, and that's epitomized when we cover up. Further, there's respect in dressing your best when meeting someone important. Really, think about it. Can you think of an important person? Somebody that you would dress up to meet?
President.
Okay. You were invited to, you know, some sort of a fancy affair with some important people there, you would probably dress your best, right? You try it. So I am a very big proponent on coming as you are. I came to the Lord just as I am. But I don't think it's a bad idea to say, you know what? There are times when, you know, I need to, at least with my attention and my attitude, I need to look up. I need to give God the respect that he is due, right? So I did this one time at church. I had pajama bottom Sunday. And I had a lady that was coming at the time. She was so offended by that. She was like, no, not even. So I only did that one time, okay? You can come in your pajama bottoms. I don't care. You can come in your shorts. I don't care. But, you know, I think you come to a place where, you know, you recognize and respect the Lord to where you're like, no, I'm going to dress a little better than that. I'm not just going to roll out of bed and just go to church in what I was wearing at night. Okay. I respect older people. Older people are big on, no, you need to dress up to go to church. And I've never said you need to do that. In fact, it's been a while since I've worn one of my suits, but I really respect older people. But it's like, you know, you put your best foot forward, okay? You need to go and, yeah, do what you're supposed to do. Well, I also love the fact that Peter jumped into the water. I mean, he just threw himself into the water. Notice, though, he respected Jesus enough to where he put on his outer garment first. You can't swim really well when you got a bunch of clothes on. I mean, that would have been rough, but you know what? Peter didn't care. He's respecting the Lord. He loves the Lord. He threw himself into the water and swam to the shore. He's got to get there to be with Jesus, okay? And the other disciples are, you know, they're dragging this net full of fish behind the boat, so it takes them longer to get there. So when they, this is verses 9 through 14. So when they got out on the land, they saw a charcoal fire already made and fish placed on it and bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish which you have now caught. So Simon Peter, here he is, impetuous Peter. I'll do it. Everybody else, get out of the way. Jesus said to do it. I'm going to go do it. Goes and grabs the net. 153 fish. That's a lot. Peter must have been strong, but he's like, y'all get out of the way. I'm going to drag this net to the shore because Jesus said to do it. All right. And then it says, although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. None of the disciples ventured to inquire of him, who are you? Knowing that it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and the fish likewise. This was now the third time that Jesus revealed himself after he was raised from the dead. So, looking at John's gospel, Jesus revealed himself on the first Sunday that he rose, right? Remember, there were 10 disciples there. Thomas was not there. Then he appears to them again the following Sunday, and Thomas is there. And now this is the third time. So I want you to notice something. The catch of fish was not for the needs of the disciples. Jesus already had food for them on the shore. What was it for? Instead, it was a miraculous reminder that apart from Jesus, they could do nothing. It reminds us of what Jesus said in John 15:5. I am the vine, you are the branches. If you abide in me, you will bear much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. You do nothing meaningful apart from Jesus. The writer of Ecclesiastes said, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. Everything you do is emptiness and worthlessness without Jesus. But with Jesus, everything you do, even the most menial task, the most mundane things you do, doing your laundry, mowing the yard, all right? Doing your job, whatever it is, maybe there's aspects of your job that you like and other aspects that you don't like. I mean, I love doing what I do. But you know what I don't love is taking up these chairs and putting these chairs out and taking up these chairs and putting these chairs out. I don't love that. But you know what? It's part of my job. And it's a test. It's a test of whether I'm going to, you know, respond with the right attitude to the Lord, you know. Maybe sometimes I can pray for the people that are going to put their butts in these chairs, you know, as I set them out there. When you genuinely commit your life to Jesus, you're ruined for doing anything but what he leads you to do. You're ruined for anything else. If you can go back to doing what you were doing before you met Jesus, maybe you've never met Jesus, all right? Or at least haven't committed your life to it. Success in business and in ministry is often measured numerically. We're supposed to give these reports every year to our denomination, the people that, you know, we're a non-denominational church, but we're affiliated with Texas Baptist. And they want this report every year. Your annual report. Do you know how many times I've submitted one of those? None. I think it's nonsense. Don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing when you give. Why am I going to count heads? I'm looking at faces, your face and your face and your face and your little face and your face and your face. Not numbers, faces, people. Oh, well, we baptized this many and our budget grew by this much in our building. We're building 5 new buildings this year. And that's the measure of success. That's not God's measure of success. It's not. And I have to get over that because part of my expectations for this church when I started it was, oh, man, you know, by the time we hit 25 years, you know, we're going to be, you know, a mega church. We're not a mega church. We're a micro church. All right. But significance in God's estimation is not a matter of numbers, but Christ-like obedience. Faithfulness means improved character. Are you more like Jesus today than you were when you first started following him? The fruit of the Spirit, right? Fruitfulness, significance, not numbers, fruitfulness. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. You're growing in those character qualities. You're becoming more like Jesus. That's what he's looking for. That's God's estimation. So then they get to the shore and Jesus broke bread with them. That's how the men on the road to Emmaus discovered it was Jesus. You remember that story from Luke? There are two men on the road to a town called Emmaus, and Jesus joins them as they're walking along. They don't realize it's Jesus. And then they invite Jesus to come with them and have a meal, and he sits down with them. They still don't know it's Jesus. He's explaining to them what the scriptures have to say about Messiah's suffering and dying and rising. They still don't recognize it's Jesus. Until when? Until he broke bread. This is Luke 24:30-32. And it came about when he, that is Jesus, had reclined at the table with them, that he took the bread and blessed it. And he broke it and began giving it to them. And then their eyes were opened and they recognized him. And he vanished from their sight. They said to one another, were our hearts not burning within us when he was speaking to us on the road while he was explaining the scriptures to us? So here it is again. Jesus breaks bread with them, right? And it's very interesting because you have an indication that they were tempted to doubt that this was Jesus. That happens consistently. Read Matthew's gospel. At the end of Matthew's gospel, when Jesus appears to them on the mountain right before he leaves the planet, it says, and they worshiped him, but some of them doubted. Okay? And here it is again. They don't doubt, but the fact that John has to tell us that some of them were tempted to is an indicator here. Okay? Let's look at what it says. Where is that? None of the disciples ventured to inquire of him, who are you? Why would they even think that they would have to venture, who are you? So it's obvious that the resurrected body is different, isn't it? And that Jesus had been through so much when he suffered, was beaten, and was crucified, that it was still hard for them, right, to believe that this was really Jesus, because they really knew he died, all right? So even those that saw him had to have faith, just like you do. You have to have faith that he rose, okay? All right, next passage, 15 through 17. Now, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon, so this is the point of the chapter, by the way. Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these other disciples? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, tend my lambs. He said to him again a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, shepherd my sheep. He said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, tend my sheep. So as I said, now we come to the point of the epilogue, the reason for chapter 21. Peter denied Jesus three times. How many times did Jesus ask him this question?
Three times.
How many times did Jesus give him a commission to tend my lambs, shepherd my sheep? Three times, okay? So this is restoration. Here we see that love is more than a feeling. It's more than devotion. Okay, it results in action. If you love me, do what I say. That's what Jesus told the disciples in John chapter 14, verse 15. And he repeated that several times in chapter 14. So Jesus commissions Peter as a shepherd at each declaration of love. Jesus is the chief shepherd. I'm a pastor. That's a shepherd. But I'm not the shepherd. I'm an under shepherd. Your shepherd is Jesus. But he has people like me that do his bidding with these groups of people that he loves, okay? Jesus owns the sheep, but he appoints under-shepherds to take care of them. And of course, that's what the word pastor means, by the way. It means shepherd. So Peter is the first appointed to this task, and it's something he speaks of, that is, Peter speaks of in his epistle. In 1 Peter 5:1-4, we read this, therefore I urge elders among you as your fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and one who is also a fellow partaker of the glory that is to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, and not with greed, but with eagerness, nor yet as domineering over those assigned to your care, but proving to be examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. So this passage, by the way, in 1 Peter, is where we find that elder, pastor, and bishop are the same responsibility. All of those are the same responsibility, right? You go to different denominations and they'll use, well, we have an elder board and the elder board is going to hire a pastor. Well, basically, all you're doing is running your church like a corporation, right? You got a corporation that's got a board of directors and they hire a president and they hire a CFO and all of this. And then you're the hired hand and you're going to do the job, but we're going to tell you, no, nonsense. That is not the way it is. The elders are pastors. And if they're not called to be pastors, then they should not be elders. And a bishop is not above a pastor. A bishop is a pastor. It just means overseer. So you go to another denomination and, you know, you have the pastor and then you have the bishop and then you have the archbishop and then you have the cardinal, whatever. We've created this structure. It's nonsense. Peter gives it to us right here. But Peter was the first one called to be a pastor, all right? Three times Jesus addresses Peter by his birth name. Notice this. He doesn't say Peter. He says Simon, son of John. B.F. Westcott says this, the contrast of the names is significant. The address of the Lord, thrice repeated, recalls the first words addressed to St. Peter in John 1:42 when he received the surname Cephas, which is the Aramaic for Peter, right? Petros is the Greek. Okay, Kaifa, Cephas is the Aramaic. Both mean rock. Not a big rock, a little rock, right? Like a stone that you could hold in your hand. So the author of our gospel, however, calls him by the name that Jesus gave him, which is Peter. So we see that Peter did become worthy of his new name, which I just told you means the rock. So, you know, Dwayne Johnson is the rock, but Peter was the original. Peter became foundational to the growth of the church. Jesus is the cornerstone, but Jesus was one of the first stones laid alongside. Peter's confession of faith must become yours too, if you were to become part of God's kingdom. So this is where we see that Jesus says, hey, you're going to become the foundation of my church. This is Matthew 16, 15 through 18. He said to them, that is Jesus said to them, but who do you yourselves say that I am? Simon Peter answered, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said to him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah. That means Simon, son of John. Matthew's written to the Jews, so he uses the Hebrew here. Because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say that you are Peter, a stone, and upon this rock, this crag, I will build my church. Which, by the way, that's where Craig's name comes from. Our own Craig Wilson, it's a crag. So he's like a large rock, right? Okay. You're Peter, and upon this crag, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it. So unlike the Catholics, we would understand that this is not saying that Peter is the foundation of the church. Peter's faith is the foundation of the church. The same faith that you need to have if you're going to be saved. The faith that can confess you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. The same faith that is the point of this gospel. I'll repeat it again. John 20:31 is the reason for the gospel. That you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Do you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? That's the foundation of the church. That faith and that confession of faith. Okay? So finally, each time Jesus asked the question, do you love me? He phrased it differently. Now, you don't see it fully in English, but you can see it in Greek. Do you love me more than these? So you see it there because the other two times he just says, do you love me? Do you love me more than these? Well, Peter had already made this great boast. You know, if though everyone else forsake you, Lord, I will not forsake you. Okay? I would die for you, Lord. So now Jesus says, do you really love me more than these? Now Peter doesn't boast. He just says, I love you. Now Peter uses, Jesus uses the word agapas, right? The noun, okay, is agape. You've heard that word, right? Agape. All right. Do you love me more than these? Agapas. Do you love me the second time? Again, agapas. And finally, the third time, Jesus asks him the question. Now he says, phileis, okay? So the Greek word for friend is philos, right? This is the Greek word for friendship love or family love. Well, Peter responded the same way the first through two times, affirming his affection and attachment to the Lord. Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Philo, which is, again, this word for friendship love. Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Philo. Jesus, do you agape me? Yes, Lord, I philos you. Jesus says, do you agape me? Yes, Lord, I philos you, right? I'm your friend, okay? I have strong feelings for you. And then he was hurt when Jesus asked the third time. When Jesus asked him the third time, he used the same word as Peter, philo, okay? That same word, philos, that is the word for, that is the basis for the word for the Greek word for friend, philos. So the first two times Jesus uses the Greek word for love, it is the word that is used in 1 Corinthians 13. What is 1 Corinthians 13 called? The love chapter. If you read 1 Corinthians 13 in the King James Version, it doesn't use the word love. It translates using another word. What is the word it uses? Charity. And this helps us to understand that this word agape, or the verb form of the word agapao, right, means sacrificial love. It's not a love with a lot of feeling in it. In fact, it wasn't used very often before the Christian church was established. It wasn't a very, very common word because it was really sort of a cold word. It was just, you know, about sacrificing for others, about, you know, so Jesus on the cross made this word what it is for us, right? This unconditional, universal love, okay? And that's what Jesus is challenging Peter to have. Jesus is challenging Peter to have that kind of love. We want to feel love, but love is not a feeling. Love is a commitment. And I've always liked the way C.S. Lewis has it. Love is a commitment to act in the best interest of that person that you love. So if you will bear with me, I'm going to go over by a little bit tonight because I am going to finish this tonight. I don't want to do it again tomorrow, okay? So then Jesus tells Peter, truly, truly, when you were younger, you used to put on your belt and walk wherever you wanted. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will put your belt on and bring you where you do not want to go. And then John says, now he said this, indicating what kind of death he would glorify God. So Peter would sacrifice his life for Jesus. Do you know how Peter died?
Upside down.
He was crucified. But he told the Roman soldiers, this is under the Emperor Nero. He told the Roman soldiers, I am not worthy. There it is again, that unworthiness. I am not worthy to die the way my Lord died. And so mocking Jesus, they crucified him upside down. That's how he died. Now Jesus said, follow me. And apparently they left the campfire and he was literally walking. Okay. So John follows behind them. Peter looks behind him, sees John, and he says, so what about this guy? Right? Jesus said, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You follow me. Hey, guys, that's what Jesus says to you. Don't worry about other people. Don't worry about their walk. Right? You may think, well, it's unfair. Here I am, I'm the pastor of this church, and I know people that are a decade or two younger than me that are pastoring churches 10 times this size. And I think, well, that's just not fair. And Jesus says, you follow me. You don't look at other people's walk. You follow me. Well, because Jesus said, if I want him to remain until I return, there was a rumor that spread that John wouldn't die. It's very probable that by the time this gospel, the final verses that I'm going to read were written, that John had already died. Okay? He did die, but he was the only one to die of natural causes. Now, we know that he was exiled on the island of Patmos, right? That's where he received the revelation. But he came back to the church of Ephesus where he had been the pastor, and he continued until he died of natural causes. In fact, the story of John's, the end of his life, is he was a very old man who would sit at the door where people would come and go to worship. And over, he would simply say, children, love one another. Little children, love one another. Little children, love one another. He is the apostle of love. Finally, I am going to finish. Thank you for bearing with me, okay? John says, or actually, this is probably not John that's writing this. This may be the Ephesian elders that write this little last bit right here to let us know. This is the disciple who is testifying about these things and wrote these things. Now we know who the author is, and we know his testimony is true. But there are also many other things which Jesus did, which if they were written in detail, I expect even the world itself would not contain the books that would be written. So B.F. Westcott thinks that these words were appended by the elders of Ephesus, where John had been the pastor for so many years. And it's here that we discover who the author of the gospel is. Now, it doesn't say John. We'll have to go back into John's gospel so that you can see why we believe this was John, who is the beloved disciple. But he is telling us that the disciple, quote unquote, the disciple whom Jesus loved is the author of the gospel. That's a phrase that's used 1, 2, 3, 4 times at the end of the gospel. He's the eyewitness to everything written here. Well, that's how John began his little epistle. So if you go to 1 John 1:1 says this, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and have touched with our hands concerning the word of life. John is the witness who relates that to us. So the question is, do you believe his witness? Do you believe his witness that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God? And by believing that, you may have life in his name. Amen. All right. God bless y'all.